Things are quickly coming to an end for us. Time is short, so it behooves us to speak the plain truth. Love and sacrifices have been made and changes initiated in service of the essence of what we collectively feel brew was made for. So it's not time to dilly-dally or tap dance. Love and sacrifice are too important for that, and when something stands in the way of naming love and service at the heart of what we do, it's time to speak it plainly and let it go. So I want to talk this morning about the evolution of religious communities like this. There comes in life moments of great transition where we are asked to very closely examine our assumptions, indeed, examine everything that we know. When new truths are revealed that we need to account for and integrate into our lives and our routines. When our routines are rigid, meaning when all of our habits and practices are set and fixed, we sometimes fail to give these new incoming truths the attention that they deserve, and the creativity and innovation these new truths present to us is sometimes ignored because to take them seriously would threaten to disrupt the stability and order that we have worked so hard to build into our existing way of thinking. The Catholic Church, refusing to consider new truths about our changing culture, has been accused of having such a rigid mindset. For instance, they didn't forgive or reconcile with Galileo until January of 2009. 400 years after Galileo's first discovery with a telescope that led him to being condemned by the church for heresy. And frankly, if that's the file that they're working on, you know there's some rigidity in that system. Conversely, to simply place new truths alongside of old contradictory truths without letting go of anything leads to confusion and chaos. Failure to let go leads to constructing a framework that is sometimes convoluted and impossible to reconcile. True integration and coherence of ideas and principles becomes impossible, and it's these kinds of systems that evolution and growth come to a screeching halt. We often think of enlightenment as a sudden, once-and-for-all single moment where everything within us and everything around us falls instantly into complete alignment, where everything from our past and our present and our future suddenly merge, and together everything makes sense. But it doesn't happen that way. Enlightenment happens more over epochs than in any single moment. It's more an endless series of little epiphanies, and each one of these epiphanies are constantly needing to be integrated. And to integrate, we often have to let go of something we once assumed was true and forever. Human beings and institutions do not grow because we find enlightenment. We grow because we are willing to engage in an evolutionary process. And that is much harder. Born out of the field of evolution and discovered within the principles, disciplines of mathematics and quantum mechanics, there is something called complexity theory. We might be more familiar with the name string theory. It is if the series of mathematical formulas that describe string theory were put into words, they would say something like this. Every system in the universe is constantly encountering forces which prompt it toward elegance or coherence. This means that every system will encounter new information and new opportunities to help it evolve in character and function until over time it becomes more refined and begins to reveal and express its fundamental purpose. To resist integrating new truth is to become rigid. And to integrate that truth without letting go of contradictions is to invite chaos. Both rigidity and chaos are signs of failure to truly integrate and develop complexity and coherence. And thus, there is a failure to grow, or in other words, just a failure to evolve. Integration, when done well, leads toward elegance and a refinement of form and function. It leads to coherence, which demonstrates that it is achieving its purpose. Ironically, thoughtful and responsible integration begins to reveal a simplicity within complexity. The process of getting there, as Einstein once noted, is very hard. Einstein once said, "Everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler." Or as Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, "I would not give a fig for the simplicity this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity." This morning I want to talk about the evolution of religious communities, and the question I really want to raise is, how will we respond in the crucial turning points of life where we are confronted with new truths? Can we integrate new understandings? And if so, can we recognize the incompatibility of old truths and summon the courage to name them and let them go? One of our great Unitarian forebears once asked us this question of the entire denomination. On May 19th, 1841, over 160 years ago this week, one of our most famous Unitarian ministers preached at the ordination of Reverend Charles Shackford in the Hawes Place Church in Boston, and his sermon was entitled "The Transient and the Permanent in Christianity," and it remains required reading for every minister entering our movement. Listen to these two excerpts of his sermon. Looking at the word of Jesus, at real Christianity, the pure religion he taught, nothing appears more clear or certain. Its influence widens as light extends. It deepens as the nations grow more wise. But looking at the history of what men call Christianity, nothing seems more uncertain and perishable. While true religion is the same thing in each century and every land, in each man that feels it, the Christianity of the pulpit, which is the religion taught, and the Christianity of the people, which is the religion that is accepted and lived out, has never been the same thing in any two centuries or lands, except only in name. The difference between what is called Christianity by Unitarians of our time and that of ages past is greater than the difference between Muhammad and the Messiah. The difference between the Christianity taught in some sects and that which Christ himself taught is deeper and more profound than the doctrine of Jesus and the doctrine of pagans. Such, then, is the transient and the permanent in Christianity. What is of absolute value never actually changes. We may cling round it and grow in it forever, yet there are always religious men and women who do not see the permanent element and thus rely on the fleeting, condemning others for not doing the same. They mistake a defense of the truth for an attack upon the holy, the removal of a theological error for the destruction of all religion. Already, men of the same sect eye one another with suspicion, and like children who've had a falling out, call one another by hard names. Now, as always, there is a collision between these two elements. The question puts itself to each follower in every generation: will you cling to what is perishing or embrace what is eternal? This question each must answer for themselves. End quote. The ability to make these critical distinctions to determine what is transient and what is permanent in our values in our priorities, in our pursuits, is often what distinguishes a flourishing, growth-filled life or a palsied and crippled one. It is the key to determining whether we'll ever actually evolve or simply just revolve through the same predictable sequence of errors and frustrations. And today, I'm not really talking about how we apply these distinctions to Christianity or even theology in general. I'm talking specifically today about how we here at Brew distinguish between the transient habits and routines that have over years become so ingrained and familiar that they may call us to diverge from the more permanent essence of who we are and what we are called to be. Things are quickly coming to an end for us. Time is short. Soon I will be gone and another minister will stand with you. Soon you will be gone and another congregation will stand in front of me. So it behooves us to speak the plain truth lest we both continue on in partnerships carrying blindly forward what is not important and failing to name and lift up what is of ultimate importance. It is by gaining sight of that possible end that prompts many toward reconciling the truths of their lives together. Hearing the alarms go off and an image of uncomfortably folding ourselves into too small a space under our desk, it strikes us we don't want to die this way. It is worth the trouble of challenging old habits, for we begin to see in doing so, if we are to die, it is better to die running toward our purpose than running away. About 5 years ago, when my mother's health started to fail her, as she started to lose her sight and her independence, I realized that this might be our fleeting chance to recognize and name some of the habits that had come between us and our shared understanding of the relationship that we both wanted. It was time to risk saying some of the hard things and to hang in there when those hard things were said to us, to express our thanks for the gifts shared, to offer our apologies for the mistakes made, to practice running home for the promise that we would not die alone. After our proverbial fire drill sounded, my mom and I had 4 years together. I got to share the feelings that I carried with me for decades, saying that she wasn't the mother that I always needed. And she was able to share with me how I was not exactly the answer to her prayers either. The truth of our hearts was spoken, and that truth cut through the apron strings of ego, and in doing so, we recognized the true umbilical cord that ran between us that transferred the blood and the sweat and the tears of the love and the sacrifice that was really at the heart of our relationship. We were able to travel those long distances that sometimes existed in our relationship so that that distance could be measured in miles rather than in lines drawn in the sand. In the end, after much work, here is what I discovered that I needed to say to her. I love you. I'm sorry for all the times where I allowed hurt or fear or my ego or my desire to control things get in the way of trusting the essence that connects us. Thank you for your resiliency and your faith and the hope that you offered, which became the cornerstone of all the love that I've ever known. And in my heart, you will always be beloved. Things are quickly coming to an end for us, and time is short. So it behooves us to speak the plain truth, lest we move on to other partnerships, still caring what is not important and failing to name and lift up what is of ultimate importance. I need to tell you before I go that I have found here in this community an enormous heart. As large and as vibrant a heart as any community I have ever been in. The love that is carried into this room week after week is sometimes so big it's overwhelming, more than what can be contained by these walls. And it extends out of this room into one another's homes. It is poured into the programs that tie you into the community around you. This love has become the umbilical cord which helps you make one body of hundreds of families and one body with a larger community around you. You have found ways to foster partnerships and forge agreements and make commitment real. And you have amazing potential to extend this life-giving energy even further. This, I think, describes your true essence as a community. That eternal and universal purpose that you were born to manifest. You are also an incredibly knowledgeable and smart congregation. When an issue arises and a decision is needed, you can count on getting at least 100 great ideas about what to do, which can be a great strength, but it can also be the thing that limits your evolution unless you learn how to integrate all of these ideas into a good process for a common and united future. I need to tell you that individuality is a great thing, but you need coordination and trust in order to channel ideas into a coherent and reliable process that avoids alienation. You sometimes mistake individual liberty for overall democracy. You elect leaders to carry out basic responsibilities, but then wonder why surveys aren't given ultimate authority in decision-making processes. And then you seem bewildered that people are hesitant to assume the responsibility of leadership. Skirmishes between personal agendas are sometimes expressed with an abundance of passion and an absence of curiosity. And a discomfort with conflict can sometimes keep you from offering the very attention that's needed to heal the hurts of the disagreements you feel and express the love and appreciation that builds bridges. You would also, I'm sure, be able to name more than a few of my shortcomings as well. My great talent for preaching longer than your great talent for listening. Preaching that often delays your passion for coffee in the company of friends in fellowship hall. My obsession with policy and structure and things like RACI charts. But the thing that I want to lift up this morning that I know has been painful to a great many people is when I removed Polylog from worship. Many people had come to count on that part of the service to meet their needs for a way to have their perspective heard and honored. And whereas many soft-spoken introverts thanked me privately, an equal number of outspoken extroverts criticized me publicly for making such a unilateral decision. Let me say a few things before I go. A couple things about that. First, I'm sorry for both the unilateral decision-making and how frighteningly disempowering it is for so many people when that happens. Although it is the prerogative of a minister to make such choices, I know that choice came with a price to the trust that is essential between a minister and a congregation. And paying that price felt particularly painful for me. I made the decision, and this is not in defense of it being the right decision, but more background about why I did it instead of simply just avoiding the issue. I made the decision for two reasons. First, I know my colleagues, and I know the general conversation that ministers have around the issue of polylog. These conversations between ministers long ago convinced me that congregations who have grown to a significant size, who still hold strong or even rigid attachments to polylog in worship, would be a red flag to many, if not most, ministers who might otherwise have been terrific potential matches. And second, one of the reasons it is a red flag for ministers is not because what's at the heart of polylog is a bad thing. What's at the heart of polylog is engagement and participation and an ability to demonstrate trust and to take risks and explore bold ideas and honor multiple perspectives. These are great things. These things are the essence of our faith. And all ministers love seeing this essence in a congregation. But although many congregations include polylog as part of their worship when they are small, they usually take it out of worship by the time they reach about 150 members. Not because what it does is no longer essential or appreciated, but because the congregation begins to recognize its own maturity and evolution. It becomes obvious that as they hire a minister and a DRE and a professional director of music, all of whom need time to carry out their ministry during the worship service, holding on to polylog and honoring the expanded depth and breadth of wisdom of their growing membership without it becoming an insider's club of the same voices becomes harder and harder to do. It simply can't continue to be shoehorned into an impossibly limited time. And in fact, it deserves a time of its own. These congregations that make this shift realize that the particular format of polylog within worship is actually a transient expression of the community's essential or permanent nature. So they creatively develop new programs outside of worship to express that something essential that has outgrown its original place. This is evolution. It's true, it may feel like the death of something beloved, and it may feel like the minister killed it, but when anything truly essential dies, it will find new ways to be reborn. The world turned on in the lathe of time. Evolution marched on in strain till life caught breath in that womb of death and crept into light again. Let me say that our shortcomings, that which is between us that caused conflict or strife, are few in comparison with the love that has been shared that is large. It has been a great honor and privilege to serve you and to be with you these last couple years. It has not always been easy, but it was not meant to always be easy. It was meant to be a time of transition and evolution. Mindful we lived, and mindful we loved, and mindful at last we died. And deep in the rift of that great cosmic drift, we struggled side by side. I have loved this chance to struggle with you. So before I go, let me say this so there are no doubts. I love you. I'm sorry for all the times where I allowed hurt or my fear or my ego or my need to control things get in the way of trusting the essence that really connects us. Thank you for your resiliency and your faith and the hope that you constantly came to, which became the cornerstone of all the love that I've ever known. In my heart, you will always be beloved. Reverend Scott McNeil will be with you next week. He is a great man and a very fine minister. Your search committee did well. I am confident that you will enjoy one another and grow with each other into a new place as minister and congregation. Do not punish him for my mistakes. Do not hold my shortcomings against him. Do not fear or hesitate to connect with him because he is not Nancy or because he is not me. He is a great man and minister in his own right, and he deserves better than those comparisons will allow. And he needs your trust and your support. Integrate him into the essence that is Brew, and let go of what is past and transient so that you can find your way together in all that is new. Love him and one another to the glory of life. That's one way to get you standing for the